Okay, quick quiz. How many women are currently on the United States Supreme Court? Wait for it. Wait for it. That's right. Three women are currently on the court. Who are they? Yeah. Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg. Yes, but how many women total have been on the U.S. Supreme Court? Wait for it. Wait for it. That, of course, is four, because now you have to remember the first one, who was Sandra Day O'Connor. Today's guest is a woman named Linda Hirschman. She's a lawyer, she's a scholar, and she's a prolific author. And her book is about the first two of those women, about O'Connor and Ginsburg. And she calls it Sisters-in-Law.
Welcome to Your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Women are not only the majority of people on this planet, not only the majority of citizens of these here United States, but they are an oppressed majority, at least according to my wife, who constantly reminds me that women have only had the franchise for less than a century now and are still underrepresented in our government, including on our Supreme Court, where only a third of the membership is female, despite the fact that arguably the majority of the court should be female if we're going to reflect demographics, or at least according to my wife, who will not give up this subject. At any rate, this episode is for her in some sense. It's for women everywhere. It's an interview with a woman. Her name is Linda Hirschman. She is a former professor. She is a lawyer. She is a prolific author of books. And her most recent book is one she calls Sisters-in-Law, and it's about the two pioneers on the United States Supreme Court, the first justice appointed, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who was then later joined by Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who still sits on the court. It's a fascinating account, not only of the similarities and differences between these two women's jurisprudence, but a good deal about their personal relationship and how they became very powerful allies on the high court. And together, they made a lot of changes.
So I'm a writer. I was trained as a lawyer. And also, I have a degree in philosophy. And I write about social movements. I'm particularly interested in successful social movements.
I'm guessing, given the title of your book, that the women's movement is the title of this one, the Sisters-in-Law.
Well, it's about the legal aspect of the women's movement. The women's movement has many, many aspects, some of which have been successful and some of which have not. But this is about the movement for formal legal equality for women, which was very successful.
Well, indeed, and we're all the luckier for it. Well, yes. Tell me then a little bit about this book. What particularly made you decide to write about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor?
So, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor are, at this moment, the two most powerful women were, when Sandra was on the court, the two most powerful women in the country. So if you're thinking about writing about social movements, it would make sense to write about them. Ginsburg got my attention first because she was the head of the ACLU Women's Rights Project in the 70s. So she was really a leader of the movement for women's equality. She was the litigator. She was the Thurgood Marshall of the women's movement.
That's an excellent description, and I think it's one that's often overlooked. Thurgood Marshall, of course, was very instrumental in the entire civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s before he was appointed to the court. And I think it's often overlooked that I think Ruth Bader Ginsburg of the sitting justices had more cases before the Supreme Court than any of them had in their previous lives, didn't she?
You know, I'm guessing that John Roberts, who was a very well-known Supreme Court litigator,
uh-huh.
He had as many cases, but John Roberts' cases didn't change the world, and Ginsburg's cases changed the world.
I see.
That's a very big difference. And so she interested me, in a way I sort of swam in her wake. She's older than I am, but as she made the world a better place when I began practicing law and living in the world that she had changed. So I was very well aware of what she was doing. if you think about women justices making a difference for women, you really cannot help but think about Sandra Day O'Connor, who was, in fact, the first woman on the Supreme Court. She was appointed in 1981, 12 years before Ginsburg went on. And, you know, as the first, and as a very, very successful first, she also changed the world for women. So I thought it would be interesting to write about the two of them. Between them, they have had such an interesting lives, and they changed the world in different ways. One, but interestingly, both of them voted for the women who appeared in front of them in women's rights litigation almost without exception. In other words, Ruth's record on women's issues on the Supreme Court and O'Connor's record are very similar, but Ginsburg did a lot of her work before she was appointed to the court, and O'Connor did a lot of her work because she was such a great symbol and such a successful pioneer.
Well, now I understand why you wrote the book, as if it required any explanation. These are two giants, certainly in the country generally, but I mean certainly among women, as you point out, the two of the most powerful women in the United States, perhaps the world. So great. Tell us about the book itself then. Where do you begin with this very important subject?
So the book opens when they are at the height of their power in June of 1996, when they were both sitting on the court together. And the opening scene is the moment when Ruth Bader Ginsburg delivers the opinion of the court in United States versus Virginia.
Mm. That's a case that I teach in my constitutional law class, and I often comment to my students that when the litigants saw that it was Justice Ginsburg who was about to deliver the opinion, the representatives of the Virginia Military Institute must have started shrinking down in their seats.
I think it was relatively clear from the oral argument that they were going to lose.
Right.
There were only eight. That actually was a court of only eight, like we have now, because Justice Thomas recused himself because his son was going to VMI at the time. But the opinion was 7-1. So
wow. Overwhelming, yeah.
Yeah, they. It was, I think, pretty clear that they were going to lose.
And just for those who haven't actually read the case or don't remember it, this was the issue of whether VMI, which by then was a state institution here in the Commonwealth of Virginia, could continue with its traditional all-male policy. And by an overwhelming majority, the court said no, that it could not. That was a violation of equal protection. So that's the starting point of your book.
Right, because it was such a beautiful moment, and it encapsulates so much of what was important in the whole book. They're together on the bench, right? It's 96. It is, in many ways, so far, Ruth Bader Ginsburg's most important opinion. It sets the standard for the application of the Equal Protection Clause to women ever since, and very high, makes it very hard to justify discriminating against women. And or against men, discriminating on the basis of sex. And so it's a very, very important case. And here's what's wonderful about it. When the justices meet in conference, they vote on how the case is going to come out. And it was 7-1. And what the custom is that once the court votes in conference, the Chief Justice of the United States, or if he is in the majority, or if he is not in the majority, the senior justice in the majority assigns the opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And he assigned the opinion to O'Connor, the first woman on the Supreme Court. Not an unreasonable thing to do, if you think about it, or disrespectful, but O'Connor would not take it. She knew who had labored for 10 long years at the ACLU to get the court to apply the Equal Protection Clause to women in the first place. And this was the culmination of that effort. This should be Ruth's, she said. And so it was. And so the opening scene of the book brings together both their individual roles and also something about their relationship.
That is a remarkably generous thing to do, because
it is a remarkably generous thing to do, because the justices don't give away those big high profile decisions very often. And if they don't write them, the assigning justices, if they don't write them themselves, they give them to someone whose vote is necessary to get to a majority. So you often see Anthony Kennedy writing the opinions now because he's the swing vote. But he was the swing vote.
He was, yes.
Right. And he still in some senses is. So it's very unusual. And it was, I learned in the course of the research for this book, rather typical of Justice O'Connor, who had a lot of self-respect and a lot of pride and was pretty clear that she knew what should and should not be done. So it isn't like she was like this mousy little woman who's always giving stuff away, but she was singularly free from the need to get more glory than she already had. She wasn't grasping in that way. So it tells you a lot about her.
Indeed it does. So that's where you begin. And that's, I'm fascinated that is that's the starting point of your book. It's an important case. It does show them both at the heights in that regard. And then I'm guessing you go back to the beginning and you talk about the disparate paths by which these two very different women came to the court.
Right. So I start with O'Connor, who was born first. And one of the nice things about writing this dual biography is that the light shone on them in turn. So there wasn't a lot of conflict or, going back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, because O'Connor was born first. So I tell the story of her very interesting childhood on a remote ranch in isolated southeast Arizona. And then 2 years later, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, was born in Brooklyn, mm-hmm. in Flatbush. And I tell about her upbringing, and I try in the early chapters to focus on what it was about their childhoods that enabled them to be such confident leaders of the movement. You know, if you think about it, really getting out of law school 10 years before the feminist movement, they were really ahead of their time. And I focus on what it is about them, their upbringing, that enabled them to go where other women would not have been bold enough to go. And I take them through college and law school. And then O'Connor tries
Before we get to their adulthood, which is of course, fascinating, and this is all fascinating, and at the risk of trivializing this, something just occurred to me. The difference between the southwestern woman on her remote ranch in Arizona and this northeastern woman in the big city in New York strikes me as remarkably similar to the two twins separated at birth in the old movie The Parent Trap. did that ever occur to you as you were writing this, that this is Haley Mills in two different guises here?
So here's what's fun about it. Even though they are as different as they could be, right? Mm-hmm. One rancher's daughter from Southeast Arizona, one in Flatbush, one Christian, one Jewish, one Republican, one Democrat, one anti-Joseph McCarthy liberal, one Goldwater girl, right? I mean, mm-hmm. one blonde, one brunette. Even though they're as different as they could possibly be, their characters were very similar. So, what I thought was so fascinating about doing this dual biography is realizing how much these two superficially different women were similar in deep ways, and that the deep ways that they were similar enabled them both to succeed.
Right. But as far as we know, they had never actually met each other at summer camp.
No, they certainly had not met at summer
camp. Okay.
When Sandra Day O'Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court of the United States, Ginsburg was sitting on the D.C. Circuit at the mm-hmm. time, and she heard about it. And she said, "I'm really glad to hear that President Reagan is nominating a woman. Who is she?" So, right. I mean, O'Connor was a pretty obscure intermediate court judge.
She was a pretty big deal back in her home state.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Linda Hirschman about her new book, Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and speak some more with Linda Hirschman. Stick around.
Stuff and things and stuff. Grieve me. I'm a bold soul sister. ESS. How?
It's time once again for the quiz, and I know this because Doug Smith is near me, and he's a cuddly guy.
Hey, Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing very, very well.
I've got a song in my heart this morning.
He's not only a cuddly guy, but he's a singing guy. Are you going to sing for us?
No.
Please.
No, your ratings would plummet. We've come too far for that.
We've got a quiz. Doug has a song in his heart, and do we have a contestant?
You sure do.
Well, who are you, madam?
I'm Katie.
Katie, where are you from?
I'm from Paris, Tennessee.
Yeah, I'm guessing there's no tower there.
There is an actual replica of the Eiffel Tower.
No way.
I promise.
Is it full size?
It's not full size, but it's pretty huge.
That is so cool. Where is Paris, Tennessee? I have never even heard of it.
It's in the farthest corner of western Tennessee on the flat end. It's just across the border of Kentucky.
My. So it's way in the western part of Tennessee. And, of course, everybody knows Tennessee is divided into three parts, the east, the middle, and the west. So that's remarkable. Well, we don't broadcast out there, so I guess you listen to the podcast.
I do.
Tremendous. Everybody's laughing in the studio at me. What are you laughing at, Doug?
I mean, you just divided Tennessee in, like, three parts.
Yeah.
East, middle, and west.
Yeah.
Like any other state doesn't have an east, a middle, and a west.
But Tennessee really identifies itself that way. You've never looked at the Tennessee flag, my friend. There are three stars on it because people really identify. Don't they, Katie?
They sure do.
Absolutely.
That's
and which part of Tennessee is the best part?
Obviously, West Tennessee is the best part of Tennessee because that's where I am.
Clearly it is. Absolutely. Of course, we're a little partial to East Tennessee at WETS, but that's okay. We accept other people as well. We're ecumenical here. All right. Doug, do you have a quiz?
I do. Yes. I've got a quiz. So, Katie, I'm going to read a question and give you four choices. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
What New York delegate to the 1787 Constitutional Convention is today being hailed as the greatest man of the founding era as a result of a Broadway musical? Is it A, John Adams, B, Alexander Hamilton, C, Sweeney Todd, or D, Donald Trump?
Okay, well, it's probably not the last two.
Donald Trump is all over social media, though.
This is true.
Okay, but he was not a founder, you're saying?
I'm going to say that he probably wasn't alive back then.
I think he just tweeted recently that he's a founder. I'm not sure exactly right. But he's great. He's great. There's no question. He's great.
Sweeney Todd, definitely a Broadway musical.
Yeah, it was Sweeney Todd. I saw that. It was 79. I saw that on Broadway in 1979, I'll have you know. But we're distracting Katie. What is your answer, Katie? Who is the founder who is now being deified on Broadway?
I don't know. It's probably
A, John Adams, B, Alexander Hamilton, C, Sweeney Todd, or D, Donald Trump.
I'm going to say John Adams, but that may not be right.
Katie?
Yes.
Do you pay any attention at all to social media?
Not really, no.
Do you get on the internet just for fun?
I do get on the Facebook.
You do get on the Facebook, and yet you still think it's John Adams?
Yes.
You're not going to change your answer?
No, I don't think so.
Doug, I tried.
It was a valiant effort. I'm afraid, Katie, it is in fact
Alexander Hamilton. My name is Alexander Hamilton, and
There's a million things I haven't done, but just you wait, just you wait.
Alexander Hamilton. Broadway musical.
Have you not been paying attention to anything in the last 8 months?
I guess not.
The country has fallen in love with Alexander Hamilton. We've started calling him things like the father of the Constitutional Convention.
Right.
And we've, you know, we've said that he is the main driver in making the Constitution a success.
Katie, clearly you need to spend more time just noodling out on Facebook. You're not wasting enough time on social media.
Apparently not. I'm just blindsided by that one.
All right. Don't feel too bad about it. You still get a Constitution from James Madison's Montpelier, and you still, as you just have, get to experience Doug Smith's ire, because Doug is justifiably irritated that Hamilton seems to be eclipsing the real father of the Constitution, who is, of course...
James Madison.
Of course, he's James Madison. James Madison needs his own musical. We could do that. Do you want to do that?
Do a James Madison musical?
You and I and Jen.
And Mark.
And Mark. We could just write our own musical all about James Madison. Mm-hmm. And then we could star in it.
Who's...
Hey, my uncle's got a bar and we could put on a show.
That sounds like a great idea.
That sounds like a great idea.
I'd like to be Washington because he actually... speaks very, very little at the convention.
I see.
Like
okay.
Twice.
I guess I'd be Madison because I'm just a Madisonian sort of fellow.
Mark is going to want to be.
You could be Dolly.
Mark's going to want to be Franklin so he can sleep most of the time.
Oh, Dolly wasn't at the convention. That's right. What's Mark going to be?
He's going to be Franklin so he can sleep most of the time.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. Well, Katie, thanks very much for playing. We appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a good day.
You too. And Doug, thank you.
You bet. It's the Constitution. I read it for the article.
After the war, I went back to New York. After the war, I went. To New York. I finished up my studies and I practiced law. I practiced law, Burr worked next door. Even though we started at the very same time, Alexander Hamilton began to climb. How to account for his rise to the top? Man, the man is nonstop. Gentlemen of the jury, I'm curious.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with author Linda Hirschman about her book, Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and changed the world. Before the break, we were talking about how politics sort of dictated that these two women were appointed in kind of a reverse order. And by that, I mean that Ginsburg was already a very prominent Supreme Court advocate, a prominent advocate for women's rights. She was at that point in the early 80s, she was sitting on the D.C. Circuit. She's a prominent federal appellate judge, but she was not the first one appointed to the bench because the president at the time was President Reagan. He's a Republican. He was looking for a Republican woman, and he found a relatively obscure state-level appellate judge all the way out in Arizona. And when Judge Ginsburg heard about that, she was a little bit surprised. But it turns out that Sandra Day O'Connor was doing great things out there in the Great West.
I interrupted you. You were going to tell us about college and all the rest of that. I'd like to hear about their early lives. What did they do, these two women of similar character?
Well, what's interesting is that they were each the object of their parents' doting affection.
Mm-hmm.
And O'Connor was an only child for 8 years until her younger sister was born. So she was alone on that ranch with her father, who liked to talk about politics, and mother, and nobody there to tell her that she was inferior. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg was also an only child. Her older sister died when Ginsburg was very, very young. Mm. So she was raised as an only child, and she was the object of her doting parents' affection. And her mother had always put her hopes and dreams on her daughter. So in that way, their childhoods, while quite different, were deeply similar. And I believe that being alone with doting parents actually made them think that they were capable of anything. And once that belief strengthened them. So they had, I think, relatively happy childhoods. Ginsburg first felt the shadow when her mother fell ill with cancer when Ruth, as she was then, the girl, started high school. And she was sick the whole time that Ruth was in high school and died the day before Ginsburg Bader that was graduated from.
Oh dear.
Yeah, and what Ruth Bader Ginsburg found out was that her mother, even though they didn't have a lot of extra money, and were, you know, really in pretty modest circumstances, had saved some money so that Ruth could go to college, so that she could go to Cornell, which she did. When they went to college, they had such similar experiences. They both met a charismatic, they each met a charismatic mentor who inspired them to go to law school. And in the course of their years at college and law school, they each met their husbands.
Now, where did Sandra Day O'Connor go to college?
She went to Stanford. Mm. Ruth Bader Ginsburg calls Sandra Day O'Connor the girl of the Golden West, which is also the name of Puccini's opera. So she went to Stanford, which was up and coming at the time, but not very establishment. So there, it had a Western openness about it that I think reinforced O'Connor's belief that she could do anything and go anywhere. Ginsburg went to Cornell and then to Harvard. She then met and became engaged to Marty, her husband, and she married him when they graduated, and he went to Harvard, and then he went into the Army. And then after the Army, he went to Harvard Law School, and she went to Harvard the year after he did.
Right. Now, I don't want to make this about the men, but my understanding is that both Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor both really found their soulmates, their love matches, and these were long and very successful marriages.
They were long and very successful marriages. I was just doing a book talk with Ira Milstein, who hired Martin Ginsburg out of Harvard, you know, in the 50s. And he and his wife were friends with Ruth and Marty all their lives. And he said it was a visible love match, the happiest marriage he had ever seen. And John O'Connor was that rare bird in Phoenix, Arizona, in the Southwest culture, a man who was really proud of his wife's rise, unconventional rise, into politics and ultimately into the judiciary. And when the moment came for him to leave a very successful practice in Phoenix and move to Washington with her so she could go on the Supreme Court, he did so.
Well, I've told my wife if she gets appointed to the Supreme Court, I'm happy to be the trailing spouse.
You know, on the other hand, it's 2016, and you would not be regarded as heroic for that.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess I missed my chance at heroism. I also understand that John O'Connor was a very good ballroom dancer, weren't they, a ballroom dancer?
Yeah, they love to dance.
Uh-huh.
Actually, both women are very physical. O'Connor loved to dance. She was a great golfer. She was a fly fisherman. It's extraordinary. And people don't realize this, but Ruth Bader Ginsburg loved to ride horses. And late in life, she went parasailing. And even now has a personal trainer that she works out with twice a week.
So after they met these wonderful men and married them and finished their college educations, these two women both decided to go to law school, right?
Right. They were inspired to go to law school by their mentors at college. So Sandra Day O'Connor didn't meet John O'Connor until law school. But Ruth Bader Ginsburg had already met and married Marty when she went to law school. But the impetus for law school was, in O'Connor's case, a man named Harry Rathbun, who gave very well-attended lectures on the meaning of life and had a disproportionate effect on her. And I found, and I say in the book, his lectures were thin and puerile. So I was not impressed by Sandra Day O'Connor's mentor. I mean, if you read them, he's like reciting Kipling and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but apparently for this girl from an isolated ranch in Southeast Arizona, the idea of contemplating big ideas about the meaning of life was very appealing. And she called him her inspiration when she went back many years later to give a lecture in his memory. She called him her inspiration. And it was good that he did inspire her to go to law school, because she was, you know, very successful at it. And we should be grateful to him for inspiring her, if nothing else. Ruth Bader Ginsburg's mentor, Robert Cushman, was a very famous government scholar, political science scholar in the 50s. And he was most famous for standing up to Joseph McCarthy and the House Un-American Activities Committee at a time when it was really a dangerous thing to do. So he has quite a great reputation in the field.
So they're both inspired by these various faculty mentors.
Right. Ginsberg worked as Cushman's research assistant.
My. Yeah. So off they go to their respective law schools, Stanford and Harvard, you said, right? Or did Ginsberg start at Columbia, or did she end at Columbia?
She ended at Columbia. So what happened was when they were at Harvard and they had taken a couple years off and Ruth had had their first child, a daughter. So she's raising a young daughter and going to Harvard. And Marty gets cancer, the age of 24. And so they had, you know, a really harrowing her second year, in which she raised their two-year-old, was on law review, helped him with all his classwork, and enabled him to graduate despite his life-threatening illness. And then he got this job in New York and was going to go to New York, and she wanted to follow him to New York and have her third year at Columbia so that she wouldn't break up the family. But there's a funny story about her going to Columbia. A lot of the guys in her class at Columbia had gone to James Madison High School with her in Brooklyn. And when they found out that Ruth Bader Ginsburg was coming to Columbia, they were unhappy because they knew that their class rank would go down by one. And it did. She graduated first in her class at Columbia.
Oh, dear. Yeah, that's the sort of person you really don't want showing up to mess up the curve at the last minute.
Oh, that's right. The last thing you want is to find out that Ruth Bader Ginsburg has come to your law school.
And in the meantime, Sandra Day O'Connor's out there at Stanford and meeting a classmate she had by the name of Bill Rehnquist, I seem to recall.
Right. She became friends with William Rehnquist at that time. And she and John and Bill and Nan Rehnquist remained friends for the rest of for as long as they all lived on the earth together. So it was a nice friendship. But she met John O'Connor while she was doing site checking for the law review. And they decided they would take their press work for the law review to the local beer joint, and that was it for them. They fell in love at that time.
That is a remarkable parallel with my own life. My wife is very, very good at doing citations. It's something at which I'm extremely poor. And I won't say that I married her for her help with my citations, but it didn't hurt. All right. So then they both graduate, and there's a famous story that at least one of them, Sandra Day O'Connor, could not get a job as a lawyer initially.
Right. So the law firms would not hire a woman. She called a million law firms. There were only a handful of women in her class, and she called a million law firms, and nobody would even consider her. So she had heard that a local attorney general in California had once hired a woman, so she went to him. She had to stay in California because John was a year behind her and he had to finish.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're hearing about the female pioneers on the United States Supreme Court, the first two female justices on the high court, Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, through the narrative power of Linda Hirschman, who's written a wonderful book called Sisters in Law. After the break, we will have our Madison Minute, and then we'll come back and finish our discussion with Linda. Please stay with us.
So many have come to know the University of Virginia as Mr. Jefferson's University. But one could argue that it is just as much Mr. Madison's. In his retirement from public office, he took a keen interest in the university, at first called Central College, where he was appointed one of the first trustees before the University of Virginia even existed. It was at Montpelier in July 1817 that the Board of Visitors started building plans and were naming professors. And in October of that year, Madison joined the visitors to lay the university's cornerstone. He fought in the Virginia General Assembly to secure passage of the bill that would authorize the school, helped to secure its Charlottesville location, and after Jefferson's death, served for 8 years as its rector, longer than Jefferson did. Under his leadership, the university library acquired over 10,000 volumes, the number of graduates grew each year, and the very first Master of Arts degree was conferred. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
And now it's time to finish our discussion with Linda Hirschman, the author of Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World. Just before the break, we were talking about how both of these women had some difficulty finding legal jobs out of law school. And now we're focusing on Sandra Day O'Connor and how she forced her way into the legal profession.
So she went to this California attorney general, asked him for a job, and he said that he had no money, and she said she'd work without pay until he got his next appropriation, and he said he had no place for her to sit, and she said she'd put her desk in with his secretary. She was clear that she was going to work as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
She had a law degree. She was going to work as a lawyer. And it's really, if you think about the mindset that women had in those years, it's an extraordinary commitment to your own well-being.
Did Ruth Bader Ginsburg enjoy, or I should say, did she encounter similar difficulty landing her first legal job?
Well, her professors went to bat for her. They wanted to get her a clerkship,
mm-hmm.
and a Supreme Court clerkship. I mean, she was one of the great law students. But none of the Felix Frankfurter, who they approached, would not take her into his chambers, no women allowed. And they couldn't even get her a job with a Second Circuit judge. And so she finally had to take a clerkship with a district court judge,
mm-hmm.
which is the lowest of the level in the district, in the federal system. And Jerry Gunther, her professor, only got the judge to take her by promising that if she failed, which is a hilarious notion, that he would get the judge, a man, to take her place.
Oh, my.
Yeah, newsflash, Ruth Bader Ginsburg did not fail.
That doesn't surprise me in the least. Now, you know, a district court, federal district court clerkship is still a prestigious post-graduation job for any law student. But on the other hand, if you're graduating first in your class from one of the best law schools in the country, you'd expect to be on an even higher track. And to their credit, her professors thought that she was qualified for that and tried to get her up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, they did. Jerry Gunther was a prince.
Mm-hmm.
And they also, interestingly, by then it was like 1959, and even though the feminist movement hadn't hit yet, society was starting to change,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we were just a year away from the 60s, and the Supreme Court had decided Brown versus the Board of Education, integrating the schools, and there was the, so things were starting to, like, stir. And she went into the academy, and she eventually started teaching law at Rutgers. So after she'd been at Rutgers for a little while, the women at Rutgers, now the feminist movement had hit, right? It's 1969. And the women at Rutgers were starting to go to law school. Women who had been out of school for a while were coming back to law school. And they asked for a course in women and the law, and she agreed to teach it. And in the course of the research into the way that the law treated women, she became indignant and decided that she would start taking some cases from her local ACLU to try to change the treatment of women by the law. And at that very moment, R.E.A. Nyer, the head of the National ACLU in New York, decided that he would start a women's rights project. And he put out a request for resumes of people to lead it and a writing sample. And as he put it in my interview with him, once he saw Ruth Bader Ginsburg's writing sample, the search was over. At the same time, in Arizona, Sandra Day O'Connor had gone to Phoenix, where the Republican Party was having a resurgence with the influx of people after World War II, and she becomes a very active and successful in the local Republican Party. And she hangs out a shingle because she couldn't get hired by any of the firms in Phoenix in the 60s. And she becomes so valuable to the local Republican Party that when her representative from Paradise Valley, where she lived, when her state representative went to Washington, she got them to appoint her to fill the vacancy in the state Senate. So she starts to pursue a very successful and groundbreaking career as a state legislator.
But she's not noted for her feminist leanings in that role, is she?
I mean, yes and no. She was opposed to, you know, she played a role in going through the Arizona body of law in Arizona and looking at where it treated men and women differently and making it more equal. So like a mini equal rights amendment, right? Mm-hmm. And she was a supporter of the Equal Rights Amendment. And she was one of the early leaders in opposing the Arizona criminal abortion law, even before the decision in Roe v. Wade.
So she was more of a feminist than I had realized, and perhaps a number of people have realized. She was working within the legislature as a Republican, but was nonetheless pushing women's rights. That's very interesting.
It is interesting. And her record on the subject of women's rights once she got to the Supreme Court is the most liberal body of jurisprudence that she has.
Mm-hmm.
So of all the areas that she opined in, women's cases were the most liberal place for O'Connor. But, you know, it was the 70s. I mean, she was not just some housewife who stumbled into good fortune. She was clear on the feminist movement was going on at the time. And remember, the Republican Party did not part company with the feminist movement until 1980. That was the year that Ronald Reagan was nominated, and that was the year that the platform included an explicit anti-choice plank, and that was the year that they stopped supporting the Equal Rights Amendment.
I see. So being a Republican...
Right. It wasn't incoherent to be a Republican and a feminist during the 70s.
So meanwhile, back in the East, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is on a tear with the ACLU.
Right. So she argued six cases. She had altogether seven cases. She had six of them, and she wrote the critical brief in the seventh one. It was actually the first case she wrote the critical brief. In the first case where the Supreme Court of the United States ever held that the Equal Protection Clause applied to women. And then she argued the six remaining cases, and she had five victories and one defeat.
Mm-hmm.
So I call them Ruth's five great cases, like Mozart's five great operas.
Yeah, I noticed you compared Ruth Bader Ginsburg to Mozart.
Right. She would like that, don't you think? Because she's a great opera lover.
Indeed she is. And just for the record, now, what are those big cases and briefly, what did they hold?
So the first case where she wrote the brief held that states could not simply distinguish between men and women because they felt like.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they applied the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment to a law that arbitrarily distinguished between men and women, preferring men for convenience.
Mm-hmm.
And the court said that you can't do. You got to have a better reason than convenience. And then she methodically began taking to the Supreme Court the laws that distinguish between men and women in a ever more robust way. So the next case was a case where the armed services had presumed that women were dependent on their male spouses if they were in the armed services, but that the male spouses of females in the armed services were not dependent. And this is a meaningful distinction because you get housing and medical care and a bunch of stuff for your dependents if they're dependent.
Sure.
So the court said, no, you can't do that either. And then the next case involved Social Security, giving widows pension to widows, but not to widowers. And so one little brick at a time, She built a wall of equality for women, taking cases each one more aggressive than the previous one had been. And in, you know, like the great law student that she was, building a wall of precedent, one brick upon the next.
And eventually somebody noticed her and appointed her to the D.C. Court of Appeals.
Well, you know, starting in 1973, a couple years after she went to the ACLU, people were talking about putting her on the bench. Mm-hmm. So there weren't some women at all, and much less of her stature. My favorite story about her in those years is that nobody ever said, "You're giving that to Ruth," because she was so stunningly well qualified mm-hmm. and competent. So in the Carter administration, there was pressure on Carter, a Democrat, to put women on the federal bench. And right before the end of his term, he nominated her, and she was confirmed just under the wire. It was a real dramatic ending, and got on the D.C. circuit in Washington, and she and Marty moved to Washington. And then she sat on the D.C. circuit for 12 years, and then, well, only Republicans sat in the White House. And then the next time a Democrat got into the White House, it was Bill Clinton in 1993, and he had almost immediately upon taking office, Potter Stewart stepped down. I'm sorry, Byron White stepped down. Mm-hmm. And that gave Clinton a vacancy. And his first choice was Justice Breyer or somebody else. He had many other people before Ginsburg. Mm-hmm. But a couple, you know, Mario Cuomo couldn't decide. And Lana, turns out it was Ginsburg. He appointed her to the Supreme Court. And she's been there ever since.
And meanwhile, back at the ranch, I couldn't resist saying that. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, you have Sandra Day O'Connor in Arizona working her way through Republican politics and the legislature. And she gets appointed to the appellate courts in her home state.
Right. First, she ran for a trial court position. Mm-hmm. And they elected the courts in Arizona in those years, and she won the election and served as a trial court judge. And then she met Chief Justice Warren Burger, who was Warren Burger's chief of staff, was the brother-in-law of the mayor of Phoenix. And so when Burger came to Arizona for a judges conference, the mayor of Phoenix arranged for the chief justice to go on a houseboat trip on Lake Powell in the beautiful northern Red Rock country of Arizona, and invited the O'Connors along to help entertain the Chief Justice. And it turned out that Sandra Day O'Connor and Warren Burger got on famously, and she really impressed him. And so when Reagan was elected, he made a campaign promise to put a woman on the Supreme Court, and then Potter Stewart stepped down, and Reagan, with some input from the Chief Justice, the archives indicate, appointed O'Connor. So she went from an intermediate appellate court in Arizona to the Supreme Court of the United States.
Which is why Ruth Bader Ginsburg would later say, "Who?"
Right, exactly. So,
because as important as it is to be an intermediate level appellate judge in a state system, it's not exactly the national stage that Ruth Bader Ginsburg had gotten for herself by litigating in front of the Supreme Court.
Well, and also Ginsburg didn't go from the ACLU to the Supreme Court. She went to the D.C. Circuit,
right,
which was a more predictable path.
Right.
But Sandra Day O'Connor was not just nobody. She was second or third in her class at Stanford. She was on Stanford Law Review. And everybody who knows her says she has two stunning characteristics. One is she's really smart, and the other is she has a fabulous emotional intelligence. She can read people very, very well. So she was an outstanding candidate, even though she came from a sort of obscure place.
Right. Well, now, she was on the court for how many years before Ruth Bader Ginsburg joined her?
12 years.
12 years.
She sat for 12 years.
So that must have been the lonely time for her.
You know, I don't think Sandra Day O'Connor has ever been lonely in her life. When Clarence Thomas was appointed and wasn't really the happiest camper in the campground, she would go and knock on his door and say, "Come on, Clarence, you got to go to lunch." And she had a million friends almost immediately. And she bonded right away with Lewis Powell, who was already on the court. And she and John O'Connor and Lewis and Joe Powell were very, very good friends. And their families were friends and they traveled together. And he really helped her learn the ropes, the unspoken ropes, and, you know, the oral tradition of the Supreme Court. She was very, very good at getting along with people, extremely sociable and extremely socially gifted. And so she was the perfect first. I don't think she was lonely.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah. And if she was, you would never hear it from her, because she always thought that you should make no excuses and no complaints.
And then even though she is a Republican appointee by a conservative Republican president, you've already told me she started to establish a fairly liberal record on women's issues, so that eventually when Ginsburg joined her, the two of them were pretty simpatico.
They were. You know, 3 months after O'Connor was appointed to the Supreme Court, she cast the decisive fifth vote to hold that the Mississippi University for Women couldn't exclude men from its nursing program.
Another case in my class, yep.
Hogan.
Yeah, the Hogan case out of Mississippi, which was engaging in stereotypes that men shouldn't be or couldn't be, or at least presumptively were not nurses.
And the opinion was so liberal that when Martin Ginsburg read it, he tossed it on, he read about it in his advance sheets, and Ruth was at that point on the D.C. Circuit. He tossed it on her desk and said, "Did you write that?"
So they were soulmates, too. So so then eventually Ginsburg joins O'Connor on the bench. And what sort of relationship did they have?
Well, they had what I call an affectionate alliance. Mm-hmm. Okay. I had sort of hoped I would catch some sneaking out for lunch into the shoe store. But right, that would have been great, wouldn't mm-hmm. it? But in fact, it's not true. Mm-hmm. So I looked so hard for that it's almost impossible that it could have happened and I wouldn't have found out about it. So they went to when Ginsburg came to the Supreme Court, she said that O'Connor meant more to her than anybody else on the Supreme Court, including the Chief Justice, who had a lot of power. Because she knew that O'Connor's life was going to change when she arrived, and she wanted it to be in a good way. And she had a lot of respect for the job that O'Connor had done as a pioneer. They had a lot of respect for one another. It's a beautiful story, and it shows that you don't have to be BFFs and go out to lunch together to make an alliance. That's very effective.
Indeed. Well, Linda, we're getting low on time. So what, again, is the name of your book so that people, I'm sure there are many people listening who want to go out and buy a copy.
Right, or maybe several copies.
Right.
It's called Sisters-in-Law, How Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg Went to the Supreme Court and Changed the World.
And that's available in your local bookstore and on Amazon right now, right?
Right, and you can buy the hardcover book, which is a very beautiful book and has a gorgeous picture of them on the jacket, or you can buy an electronic version, and there's an Audible version.
Well, tremendous. Well, Linda Hirschman, thanks so very much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Linda Hirschman for telling us all about those two pioneering women on the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. What an inspiring tale. Executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by Jen Patia Howell of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Our music is by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment.